Irish Illustrated Insider subscribers. This is Drew Mentak, and I'm here to bring you the sixth episode from our bi-weekly podcast series on the feed, Irish Illustrated Interviews. Today, we're sharing my conversation with esteemed college football writer and journalist Ivan Maisel, who's covered the sport for more than four decades. Over his illustrious career, he's worked for the Dallas Morning News, Newsday, Sports Illustrated, ESPN, and others. He's also been recognized nine times for the best story by the Football Writers Association of America and is a member of the FWAA Hall of Fame. Most recently, he's the author of American Coach, The Triumph and Tragedy of Notre Dame Legend Frank Leahy, which was released on September 16th. The book explores the often forgotten legacy of Leahy, who led the Fighting Irish to six undefeated seasons and four national championships in an 11-year span. Still, he lacks the recognition of Notre Dame championship-winning coaches who came before and after him, like Newt Rockne and Ara Parseghian. We spent a great deal of our time exploring Leahy's life and career. We also delve into what it took to conduct research for the book, the access Notre Dame provided, and how the process has changed his perception of Notre Dame. Here's my interview with Ivan. I'm here with Ivan Maisel. You covered college football on a national level since 1987 while working for publications like the Dallas Morning News, Newsday, Sports Illustrated, ESPN, and others. You've been recognized nine times for the best story by the Football Writers Association of America. And of course, last month, your latest book, American Coach, The Triumph and Tragedy of Notre Dame Legend Frank Leahy was released, which I'm eager to discuss, Ivan. And thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Drew. Yeah, I'm excited to be here, and I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, so first, I asked all my guests about their first memory or connection to Notre Dame. Usually they've worked or played for the team, but what's your answer as someone who, born in Alabama, who went to Stanford and then began your career covering Clemson back in the early 1980s?
Well, I have my memory of my childhood is of Notre Dame regularly getting in Alabama's way. You know, my parents went to the University of Alabama, so I grew up in an Alabama house going all the way, and I remember it all the way back to 66. I was in first grade, and, you know, that Alabama finished undefeated with no ties and yet did not win the national championship, as perhaps you are aware. And then, you know, 1973, I was in ninth grade. And, you know, New Year's Eve, that kind of petered out well before midnight because of the Sugar Bowl. And then, the next year, the Orange Bowl, like another national championship shot that Alabama lost at the hands of Notre Dame. And it was, I keep hitting my laptop.
Sorry. I do the same thing sometimes.
Yeah. I'll do this. I am well aware that Bear Bryant went 0-4 against the University of Notre Dame. And so, you know, that was my earliest exposure to the Irish. And then my first game I covered in South Bend was actually 1987, my first year in Dallas, and just happened to be Notre Dame and Alabama. And they both had good but not great records, and Notre Dame blew the doors off of Alabama. And it was really the first in my memory, as I recall it, it was the first indication that Lou Holtz had turned a corner. I think the final score was 38-7, and it really wasn't that close. But that was my first time on campus, and I was, as everyone is, if they love college football, blown away. And I don't know how many games I've covered at the university since then. I have been in all three press boxes since 1987. And I just really came to, as a fan of college football, appreciate and love the place.
That's interesting. And I do want to kind of just get right into the book, because I thought it was really interesting as I've started to get into it. just, I think, frankly, at least Leahy, as somebody who grew up in South Bend, I would see like the banners that show all the championships, and you would see he has four. You're like, why don't I really know about who this person is? So I think it's really interesting that you kind of wanted to get into that. And I know, you know, in some of the footnotes, you reference past biographies that were written by him. But what made you want to kind of re-dig into this person that has this prestige and success at Notre Dame, but isn't as well recognized as a Rockne or even an Air Parsegian today?
Well, that's what struck me as odd, because Leahy's record is a virtual tie with Rockne in terms of winning percentage. I think Rockne has like a 2.5 game lead, and Leahy and they are 1-2 in the history of college football for any coach that has coached at least 10 years. So I didn't understand. I certainly know and appreciate why Rockne remains an iconic figure, not only at Notre Dame, but in the sport. But Leahy has just become a name in a record book. And I was trying to figure out why has nobody, when I first got this idea, I thought about it and I thought, well, nobody's written about him, or maybe I've just missed something. And, and I scoured Amazon and I scoured used book websites, and I couldn't find anything. And since the year after he died, 1974, a posthumous autobiography came out called Shake Down the Thunder. And it's a terrific book written by a sports writer from the Bay Area named Wells Twombly, who was very good. And, but that was it. That was it. And I thought, my God, a whole, two generations of people have gone by, and there's got to be some great stories to tell. And boy, are there.
Definitely. And something I thought that was interesting that I think you made, kind of the point you made early on in the book, is that it was Cal and maybe one other team you kind of noted had early success, like maybe right before or right after Rockne. But then the next coaches, or at some point, that didn't continue. And then they just became kind of another college football program. And that Frank Leahy, building on Rockne's success, you know, maybe a decade or so later, kind of cemented Notre Dame's status. So I'm curious why, I guess kind of going back to my earlier question, why is he kind of forgotten when without him and him, you know, winning four championships and returning Notre Dame to that early glory, we may not look at Notre Dame the way we do today.
Well, yeah, I mean, I absolutely believe that, because there are schools that had early success and then we don't think about them anymore, at least in the way we think about the Notre Dames and Alabamas and Michigans and, you know, et cetera. I have written this book. I did a couple, really almost 3 years of research. I don't know that I can give you an answer. I think Leahy was a bit of an introvert. I think he was his relationship with the university post retirement was fraught. It was not great. Part of it was his own fault. He was, and they all made up toward the end of his life, but he just kind of disappeared. And maybe it's that once Notre Dame reclaimed its great success under Era and then subsequently under Devine and Holtz, maybe they just parked Leahy away. I don't have an answer. I didn't really try to figure out why that happened. It was just, to me, I wanted to explain, why he should have remained and should return to the forefront of people's thinking.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because as you know, like, he's somebody, I'm not sure I should look this up, as if he's made the College Football Hall of Fame today, but I know that was something that was delayed significantly too. So clearly, maybe just even with how he was kind of included in amongst national college football writers at the time, I do wonder if that's part of the reason why he just didn't get that celebration that Rockne does and others have.
Well, nobody made a movie about Leahy's life. No presidents played him on the silver screen. It did take him 13 tries to be elected to the College Football Hall of Fame. And even when it was done, it was almost a recognition that he was in poor health and he wouldn't be around much longer. But yeah, they you know, and that was really his peers. His peers didn't like him all that much and didn't feel they wanted to honor him. Part of it was his personality. Part of it was another thing that happened to him after he quit coaching. He had he was a terrible businessman and he got in trouble. He got his hand slapped by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he was really a victim of the guys that hired him. But nonetheless, it didn't look well. It didn't look good for him, and therefore, the Hall of Fame didn't think it would look well for them. You know, there were a lot of reasons that he just sort of disappeared.
So I guess we talked a lot about why he isn't remembered, but why should he be remembered after you did all this research on the book?
Well, initially my thinking was, he's got the equivalent of Rockne's record, if not a little better, in terms of he played a harder schedule than Rockne did and had more undefeated seasons and, won national championships that, of course, weren't available to Rockne, because the AP wasn't around yet. But as I learned more about his life, Drew, I really thought he is a, his life explains a lot about 20th century America, not only the bootstrap part of it and that he came from nothing and became a national celebrity for many years, made the cover of Time magazine back when that was a thing, and was on all the radio shows and was a national TV figure once TV came around. But also the price he paid for that success, I think, was also a quintessential American story that, people tell, and not sports writers, but playwrights and novelists. And, he paid for his success with his health. He paid for his success with a fraught marriage. And he didn't know what to do with himself if he wasn't trying to win a football game. And that might, the last 20 years of his life, he just sort of wandered around. He was in business. He made some speeches, but I think what you're asking me about, about his legacy, I think once he got off the sideline, he really didn't know what to do with himself. And I think that added to people forgetting about him.
And what I heard you kind of, I think it was on the Ringers, the Press Box, you kind of compared his career a little bit to Urban Meyer's, just in terms of you have a lot of success, burn yourself out. And I think you even mentioned that Urban Meyer did come back at one point. But I guess kind of, could you dive a little bit more into the parallels between maybe their two careers and why that might be the best modern comparison?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Urban had success everywhere he coached. I mean, we all recognize that he was, won 10 games at Bowling Green, I think. He went undefeated at Utah. He had great success at Florida. But by the end at Florida, the stress had gotten to him so badly that his health was terrible. And he had to sit out. He had to stop out from coaching, tried to come back at Florida. It didn't go all that well. And he finally left and, sat out a few years and then came back to Ohio State. Wins another national championship, his third. But pretty soon the stress, took its toll on his health again. Now we're all waiting to see if, now that he's in his 60s, does he come back? Leahy tried to come back, 4 years after he left Notre Dame, and actually was hired by Texas A&M to replace Bear Bryant when Bryant went to Alabama. But his tenure there didn't really last a week because he went to, he told the Texas A&M people, I'm going to go back home and just get my doctor to give me a clean bill of health, and you'll be satisfied and I'll be satisfied. And he went to get a checkout. checkup, and his doctors went, no, you know, what are you, nuts? You know, I mean, I'm not, you know, just in this week alone, all your stress levels have shot up. And so he called Texas A&M and just said, I'm not coaching.
And it kind of seems like his, I mean, even going back to his upbringing, you mentioned growing up in South Dakota, kind of sounds like he had a maybe rough go of it to a degree physically. It sounds like his dad wanted him to be a boxer more than a football player. And put him in some semi-professional fights that, you know, kind of went his way because a older gentleman was disqualified, but he still took a beating. And then that's kind of seems like how his football career at Notre Dame went as well, which then ended prematurely. Yes. But is that kind of, did those health issues just kind of continue throughout his entire life, or was it really just the coaching thing that ended up wearing him
down? I think it was just the stress. Leahy let nothing stand in his way of succeeding on the football field. And, you know, there's a wonderful little story that he would tell. Leahy played for a guy who in high school, Winter High School in South Dakota, who had played for Rockne. And this guy wrote Rockne a letter and said, I got two players here who are good enough. You know, I want to send them to play for you. And Rockne said, great. Here's, you know, they have a scholarship. And one of them got cold feet. A guy named Clayton Balfany. At the beginning of the summer before their freshman year, he said to Leahy, I'm not going. I'm going to go somewhere where I can play. We're not good enough to play at Notre Dame. And that one conversation, Drew, really spurred Leahy for the rest of his life. He was going to prove he could win at Notre Dame, and he could play at Notre Dame, and he could win at Notre Dame. And he got to Notre Dame and won a starting job, but he couldn't keep it because he couldn't stay healthy, which really means that his buddy Clayton was right. You know, he certainly wasn't big enough to play at Notre Dame. He may have been good enough, but he's not going to let anything stand in his way of succeeding. And, he pushed his players harder. They practiced more than anybody else. Their conditioning was better than everyone else. They won a lot of games in the fourth quarter, or pulled away from people in the fourth quarter. And that's just who he was and how he coached. And it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
That makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned Rocky, and I think that's an interesting part of the book where you kind of get some insight into his relationship. And that's somebody he met. You mentioned how he got recruited. It's not like he had some, like he would today, he didn't have a relationship with Newt Rockne before he got to campus. But I think with somebody who is such a, I guess, kind of synonymous name with football and a legendary career with Rockne, it's kind of interesting to see, at least in his dealings with Frank Leahy, that he kind of always lived up to that, even in his first conversations. Newt Rockne and Leahy, like, he was already motivating him and knew what he needed to do to kind of push his buttons and kind of get him enthused. And then he obviously, Rockne saw something in him too. But what was it like to kind of see how maybe significant that connection actually was? Because it sounds like maybe you went into the book, maybe this is just me reading into it, but you went into it maybe thinking like it could be a little bit of hyperbole that Rockne saw something in him. But it sounds like the more you got into it, the more you saw like, okay, no, this was a real connection.
Well, that's an interesting, question. I, for somebody that's covered football as long as I have, I had a layman's knowledge of Rockne, and I think I've even read a biography of him, but I hadn't really focused on him a whole lot. And this was a window into how he worked. His people skills were off the charts, which was what made him such a magnetic personality, and which is what made him a great coach. And he saw something in Frankie, as he called him, and he remarked, and you know, a little. Sometimes I wasn't quite sure how many grains of salt to take with anecdotes like these, because they came out of the PR factory of Notre Dame in the 40s. And I talk a little bit about that in the book of, you know, what was real and what wasn't. But, you know, Rockne took a shine to Leahy and recognized in him a keen football mind. And there is, you know, there is no dispute that, you know, Leahy blew his knee out 3 days before the first game of his senior year and never played a down. And after the season, which 1930, Notre Dame went undefeated. It was Rockne's last year. Rockne took Leahy to the Mayo Clinic after the season with him, and they spent 10 days together in a hospital room. Leahy got his knee fixed. Rockne got treated for phlebitis, the phlebitis that dogged him in the last years of his life. And they just talked football for 10 days. And you know, Leahy was no dummy. He knew what he had there. And he, toward the end of the stay, he asked Rockne, you know, he said, I think I want to get into coaching. And Rockne handed him a folder with letters from six head coaches around the country asking him to recommend a young assistant coach. And he said, pick where you want to go. You know, which is amazing because Leahy was 22 years old. And Georgetown was the letter on the top of the pile. The coach at Georgetown had been a freshman coach at Notre Dame when Leahy got there and had coached Frank's older brother, Gene, at Creighton University in Omaha. So that's where he went. And he was off to the coaching races from there. But, you know, Rockne, he considered Rockne a father figure. He really, he looked to him in a way and felt like he got love and concern from him in a way that he didn't get from his own father. And 3 months later, Rockne was gone. 4 months later, it was the end of March. And at that, I guess that's 3 months. But anyway, he didn't, that really hit him hard.
Mentioned earlier that the last biography before yours book came out that had been written, I believe you said it was 1974. And I know you got some access through Notre Dame to kind of go through some archives and do some extra digging. I guess, what was that process like? Like, what type of materials were you going through to do research from like the 1920s to 40s and kind of probably a little bit after that? And what are some of your favorite things that you found that you could add to his story that maybe hadn't been told?
Oh my gosh. There is no school that has as deep an archive of its athletic department as Notre Dame. And I don't think there's anywhere close, maybe Michigan, but you know, Notre Dame's is more comprehensive. And there were, you know, office memos from his early years between the priests who were running the university and Leahy, you know, them sending the equivalent of how we text one another, you know, them just sort of keeping one another up to date on what was going on, and letters Leahy would write from the road to the priests who were running things. And I certainly wouldn't have seen any of that anywhere else. So that was really cool. And then newspapers.com, which is a subscription website and has thousands of newspapers, available to its subscribers, including the South Bend Tribune, which, you know, I didn't click on more than, you know, 20,000 times during the course of my research, but also had the O'Neill Frontier from O'Neill, Nebraska, which was Leahy's birthplace and where he had the one fight that you talked about earlier. And, you know, I thought that fight was apocryphal because it was mentioned in feature after feature about him, but there were never any details. And I thought, is he making this up? But finally, there was one detail that led me to the O'Neill newspaper. So that was kind of cool too. That's a separate podcast, the stuff I found, Red Smith's columns. Red Smith, who is the patron saint of American sports writing, at least for the second half of the 20th century, and was a Notre Dame grad, and his donated his papers to the university. he wrote most of his career at the New York Herald Tribune, which hasn't printed in 60 years, but Notre Dame had access to to digitize New York Herald Tribunes. And the day that Greg Bond, the archivist on campus, found the columns that Red Smith wrote about Frank Leahy was my favorite day of this whole last 3 years. You know, I was so excited. And Red Smith was just, he was so good and had such a keen insight into Leahy, which I got into in the book, story after story and anecdote after anecdote.
Yeah, I've used newspaper.com a few times before, and I think it's always fascinating to go back to see how much the writing or what wasn't included back in the day, especially, I mean, 1920s. I tried to look for stats before, and you realize they just didn't think about it the same way we do. No. So I'm sure it's always more of a challenge than people even realize going through that stuff, because it just isn't put together how we, I mean, oftentimes if you go far back enough, there's no pictures either. So you're just scanning for relevant headlines.
Oh, and I'll give you another quick example. You know, John Wooden mentions in one of his books that he learned more about coaching from Frank Leahy than just about anyone else, because he went to a practice one time at Notre Dame, and I found the practice he went to in the South Bend Tribune. He was the coach at South Bend Central High, and they had been upset in the Indiana State tournament. They were top seed and had lost in the round of 16 or the quarters, I don't remember. And it was March, and you know, Leahy invited him to come watch practice. And you know, it was mentioned in the notes of the practice that week, you know, in the Tribune. And you know, he often said he learned more about how to organize a basketball practice by watching Leahy run a football practice than he did from anyone else. That was cool.
Definitely. And that's definitely interesting, too, going back to the legacy thing. If you look at, I mean, John Wooden, I believe he coached Vince Lombardi at Fordham. Leahy did as well. Yeah. So to have two of these like kind of magnanimous coaching legends that kind of still last the day today, like he had an influence on those people, but maybe didn't get quite the same the level of treatment, which we've already talked about. But that's really just another element that makes it so interesting that he is so successful, but kind of also forgotten.
No, and you know, one of the first things the editor of the book said to me after I sent him the manuscript was, really cool, the cameo, the people who made cameo appearances in this book. And I think that speaks a little bit to who Leahy was in America at the time. You know, Lombardi, Wooden, you know, he hung out with Hollywood stars, you know, in the off season, went to football games with Bing Crosby, hung out with Don Ameche. You know, I mean, there's a great anecdote from a Red Smith column about meeting Mickey Mantle at the end of the 1952 baseball season and the beginning of the 1952 football season. You know, Mickey Mantle, who was almost an Oklahoma Sooner back for Bud Wilkinson. You know, so there were just, he was, I mean, on the American sporting scene in that post-war era, the decade after the war, Leahy was front and center.
You mentioned kind of getting into the archives and seeing some of his correspondence with priests and stuff involved with the university. And I know kind of especially towards the end of his tenure, I believe that's when Father Hesburgh was kind of taking over, and kind of sounds like he had a vision for what the university could be. So he was kind of using the football program to get them the academic prestige or notoriety that he wanted to, while also trying to maybe push back against its academic narrative at the same time. How do you think that might influence Leahy's kind of legacy, having to deal with that figure who also became, I mean, Hesburgh had a documentary come out recently on just all the influence he had in the 1960s and even beyond that. So he kind of is in a weird way sandwiched between these two really prominent figures, one not in sports and one in sports, that maybe that might have an influence as well.
Oh yeah, no, and Patrick Creedon, who directed Catholics versus Convicts, did the Hesburgh documentary, and you know, he's a really talented guy, and he's a friend of mine, so I want to plug him. you know, look, Hesburgh had a vision and a determination to make Notre Dame a world-class academic institution that was every bit as powerful as Leahy's drive to win football games. And those two things got in each other's way. And Hesburgh had the upper hand because he was, you know, when he came onto the scene in Leahy's life, he was the number two guy at the university. And then he moved up to the presidency for the last two seasons of Leahy's career. And they clashed. They clashed. And there is, you could, if you ask, I found if you ask 10 people who are Notre Dame scholars whether, Leahy resigned or Hesburgh was pushed him out, you'd get 11 opinions. I think Hesburgh orchestrated Leahy's resignation. Leahy's health was poor enough that, Hesburgh also was greatly concerned about, the rest of Leahy's life, but football was in Hesburgh's way. And, you can see by what happened in the decade after Leahy left to football, and what happened to the university as everything focused on academics and building that side of the university up. Hesburgh didn't want Notre Dame to be known first for football. And once he got the academic side on firm footing, he went back and hired Era. And, he got both done. But he was going to do whatever he had to do to make people recognize the academic side of Notre Dame. And if that meant parking football at the curb for a while, then that's what he was going to do. And that's what he did.
That's interesting. And I feel like until maybe even the last 15, 20 years, maybe even not that long, that kind of balance and push back and forth between athletics and football around South Bend has kind of permeated through it. Obviously, they've still won, three different head coaches, as we mentioned, have won national championships since Leahy left. But it seems like that dynamic is in a much healthier place, but it has definitely been issues even after that.
Oh, it's much healthier, and there's much more of a recognition of we're good for each other. And I think the whole stadium project, Campus Crossroads, I think, is that the name of it?
Yes.
Forgive me if that's not right, but I think that's right. Is a recognition that, football has a big place on this campus and can serve academics just as well as everything else on campus can. And I think the university is in a much healthier place because of that. Everybody, everybody's gung-ho for football and everybody's gung-ho for Notre Dame to be a great university. And, there aren't many places that can pull that off, but Notre Dame's doing it.
With doing a lot of the research for this book and going back to, the 1920s and a little bit after that, that's kind of around the time. And even something you, I guess, note with Leahy is that he wanted to go to Notre Dame because he grew up a, Catholic kid in South Dakota, and that's where you just wanted to go, and even touch on maybe some of the prejudices or things like that Catholics were dealing with at the time. I'm curious, I feel like independency for Notre Dame is always a topic at the forefront, and they certainly may have to join a conference at some point in the near future, but do you get a maybe greater sense through doing this research on the importance of independence historically for Notre Dame, or is that maybe changed or adjusted your understanding of that at all?
I got a much better understanding of the roots of the independence in this, and a much clearer picture of the how prevalent anti-Catholicism was, both when Leahy came up and even up to through the post-war period. And how insular the Catholic, national Catholic community was. And I know a little, I grew up Jewish in the South. I have an idea of that, what that insularity means, but it was fascinating to see what Notre Dame, you know, how what Rockne did when the Western Conference, the Big Ten, would not take Notre Dame, and how he pivoted and took Notre Dame to all the big cities where the Catholic immigrants were, his people were, Notre Dame's people were, and what that did for the university and for the athletic department, mainly for the football team. You know, so I got a much clearer picture of that. And it gave me a much greater appreciation of how far the university came and how far the football program came to succeed at the level that it did. Because really, by the post-war era, in Leahy's heyday, there was only, in American team sports, there was only Major League Baseball and college football. You know, NFL was an afterthought. NBA was just getting started. And in those two, you know, baseball and college football, there was really only the Yankees and Notre Dame. So they were, you know, they were the only national team in a regional sport really up until the 90s. And, you know, that they took full advantage of that pulpit.
We touched on kind of at the start when you started, when you became a national writer and first went to a Notre Dame game. I'm kind of curious on how, if you could talk a little bit about how Notre Dame and the, maybe the perception of the football program has kind of ebbed and flowed and to where it is today over your, you know, tenure as a college football writer.
It's been interesting, and it's really reflected the ebbs and flows of the sport as a whole and the powers, you know, what has happened in the sport. I think, you know, the quarter century after Holtz retired, you know, Notre Dame struggled a bit nationally. And part of that was, you know, in the BCS and in the first early years of the playoff with the four teams, it was very hard, not only for Notre Dame, but a lot of schools to crack that ceiling to get into that, you know, elite group, which is why, and it's, I don't think it's giving short shrift to Nick Saban or Kirby Smart or Dabo Swinney, but there was only room for four teams at the top. And, you know, in Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, Ohio State, you know, they were the dominant teams. And that was hard for Notre Dame and a lot of other schools to make that leap. You know, now that we've expanded the playoff to 12 teams, and now that NIL and the portal have allowed talent to spread out among more campuses, I think that plays right into Notre Dame's hands. Again, a national university with a deep foundation of fans, the will to spend the money to succeed, and its own network. I mean, you know, I think everything that Notre Dame has bodes well for them in this era. So, you know, I think, you know, we're getting back into the feast years after some years of famine.
It was kind of apparent. I forget if Leahy was 30 or 32 when he took over head coaching at Notre Dame. So even younger 32, than 32 than Marcus Freeman was when he was 35 when he took over Notre Dame. But I couldn't help but think of some parallels. And I think there's a lot of fans who are already wondering, like, how long can somebody sustain as head coach at Notre Dame, just giving the pressure and stuff like that. Do you think some of that pressure was unique to Leahy, or do you think it's a place where there is so much pressure and so many different things where you are still dealing with academics and appeasing the president maybe in a different way? Do you think there is still challenges with sustaining a job like that?
Yeah, I absolutely. And I think as far as Leahy's career, it was all of the above. I mean, he put a lot of pressure on himself because that was his nature. But he also put a lot of pressure on himself to try to make Notre Dame what he thought people believe Notre Dame was. And he didn't want to let the fans down. And that's a big load to take on. And it cost him. Freeman seems to handle it a lot better. And I haven't watched him with a microscope, and certainly haven't spent as much time, you know, looking at him as I spent with Leahy, but he seems to have a better handle on it. Part of that might be he sees the bigger picture. I mean, he's got a big family, but he seems to pay attention to them, you know, which is more than we can say for Leahy. But that's also how families operated in the middle of the 20th century in America. You know, he went out and did his job, and his wife was at home with the children. Probably could have gone home more or occasionally. During the season, he spent the week on a cot in the firehouse on campus rather than drive to Michigan City to Long Beach. But I think the pressure today on Marcus Freeman is probably not as focused as it was on Leahy, because, you know, Notre Dame was the national team back then, whereas Notre Dame is one of many teams that have national followings. And plus, as a society, our attention spans are all, you know, fractured these days.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Curious. I'm not sure how much time you going through the archives and stuff, how much of that was done in person or Notre Dame maybe sending you things, but I'm curious if you spent more time in South Bend, if there's, as somebody who grew up here, I feel like the town has improved pretty significantly over the last decade or so. I'm curious if there's any places you felt like you gravitated to quite frequently, or how you kind of spent your time around town when you weren't doing research.
Oh, I made 4 trips to the Hesburgh Library of an average of 3 days a trip. I mean, it's night and day to when I was coming there in the 80s and 90s, you know, and a lot of that is, what is it, Eddy Street, you know, yes, right off campus. Yeah. I mean, you know, the first time I saw that, my mouth dropped open, you know, like, oh my God, you know, and I spent time, you know, I certainly stayed there so I could just walk over to campus, and the restaurants up and down there are good. The Trader Joe's at the other end of the street, you know, I go grab stuff for my hotel room. The restaurants in Mishawaka, I don't know that I'd heard of Mishawaka until, you know, I'd been going to Notre Dame for a while. You didn't go over there, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it completely night and day to what it was, but it should be night and day, Drew. I mean, you know, I started coming almost 40 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. No, I appreciate that. It covers most of my questions. We've kind of already touched on different things, but maybe what's one thing that you learned about Notre Dame? Maybe it has nothing to do with Frank Leahy that really kind of stood out to you about the university, or kind of gave you a much better sense for something about it.
I think just I have a much better understanding of the university now and of the forces that shaped it. And if you don't grow up a Notre Dame fan, you see Notre Dame as this monolithic football power, and that's always been at the top. At least that's how I pictured it, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, reading Sports Illustrated and the Sporting News, you know, every week. You get there and you learn the struggles that Notre Dame went through and the fight that it had to be not discriminated against and to be taken seriously. And it gave me a much better insight into why the university did things the way that they did it. And, you know, and I'm not even getting into the church and that, you know, impetus, you know, because I don't know a lot about that, but I understood the prejudices that Notre Dame faced a lot better after I was through with this research than I did before.
Well, I believe the book came out on September 16th, so it's been out for a little bit. But what's the best way for people to find it if they're interested in picking it up?
What a great question. Well, you know, I mean, it's available, as they say, wherever you buy books. I did an event, Purdue Weekend at Hamas Bookstore on campus, and it went so well that I'm coming back for Navy. And I'll also be in South Bend, speaking at the South Bend Museum on December 14th about Leahy's relationship to Rockne. There's a Rockne exhibit at the South Bend Museum that is, from what I hear, is fabulous. And I'm really excited to go see it and to be a part of it. But American Coach is available everywhere.
Awesome. I'll have to go check out that exhibit. And I believe the Navy game is November 8th for anybody 8th. Who's wondering.
Yeah, I'll be in the bookstore on the afternoon of the 7th and at the very least. And but more to come on that.
So, well, thank you so much for your time and answering all my questions. And everyone listening, we'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. Talk to you then.